touched you. Everyone did.
Yes, but one. Someone.
He felt power leave him, he said.
And there was the woman. Head bowed, afraid to look up, shaking.
I felt power leave me.
Did you? He said. Did you feel anything?
Yes. Something changed. At that moment...
She was cured. The ailment left her then and there.
From a distance of 2,000 years, it's difficult to identify with some gospel stories. But not this one. The story of the hemorrhaging woman who reaches out and touches the hem of Jesus' garment reaches across continents and centuries to speak directly to people like Marion Chatterley, a chaplain working with people who have HIV at the Milestone Centre in Edinburgh.
A blood-borne virus has psychologically a different effect on people from an illness that perhaps only affects a particular part of their body. I think there's also something about the kind of messiness of blood. And people know that if they're living with HIV, then their blood is infectious and it's potentially dangerous for other people. There's a parallel there, that sort of messiness and the woman having to manage her bleeding. There's a taboo surrounding that.
And because she was menstruating, this woman was unclean. She couldn't be touched.
Mm. And I think that absolutely illustrates the way many of the people living with HIV feel. So people will talk about feeling dirty and unclean and being perceived in that way by others.
We have our social conventions. It isn't just that people in the first century had odd social conventions. And people in the first century would know that a woman who was unclean because of her illness would no more come into a crowd and touch a holy man, a prophet, or somebody, than the Prime Minister would walk out into Downing Street wearing boxer shorts.
Tom Wright is the Bishop of Durham.
And so it is a huge shock, but then it's a double shock because she gets healed and they realise there's something going on here which is completely mind-blowing. And Luke sometimes has the crowd say things like, we have seen inexplicable goings-on today. And Luke wants to get that sense of shock and excitement at something new and something they can't explain.
That something new is not only the healing power of Jesus, but the message that goes with it. That God seeks out and embraces those shunned by society. Luke's gospel is often called the gospel of the outcast, and not without reason. It's crammed with tax collectors and sinners. And Luke appears particularly concerned with one group among the excluded, women. On my journey behind Luke's story today, I want to find out just how radical his Jesus really is. Loveday Alexander, Professor of Biblical Studies at Sheffield University, has made a study of the position of women in the Greco-Roman world.
If you go, for example, to Pompeii, where we know a lot about everyday life, women leave very little trace in the public records. They're not in the inscriptions, they're not very much in the documents. There are quite a lot of them in the graffiti, because they're very prominent in the street life. This was a very sexy city. But we also know that women lived an indoor life, so they appear on the walls of elite houses in wall paintings. And there are also the invisible women, the servants, the slaves, and the businesswomen, who were playing an increasing part, but were not ever recognised as part of the public life of the empire.
Would it have been different in Jewish society?
I think you have to look at that very much across a whole range of statuses and classes. We have writings from Jews who are part of the elite male aristocracy, if you like, people like Philo and Josephus, and they reproduce, okay, in Jewish terms, but they reproduce basically the same things that Aristotle says about women. You know, the wife should be chaste, she should be obedient to her husband, she should never go out. Even to go to the temple, she shouldn't be seen in the marketplace in broad daylight. She should go when it's quiet. So very much an indoor life, almost a life of purdue, you might say. So there would be differences, but they think they're differences across the class spectrum and differences between town and village rather than essential differences between, say, Jewish and Roman attitudes to women.
So women in the world of the first century had a tough time of it. But by contrast, Luke tells us of women from Galilee who accompany Jesus and his disciples, and they appear to enjoy considerable independence. Just how unusual this was, we can't be sure.
Jesus went on through cities and villages, proclaiming and bringing the good news of the kingdom of God. The 12 were with him, as well as some women who had been cured of evil spirits and infirmities. Mary, called Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had gone out, and Joanna, the wife of Herod's steward, Chuser, and Susanna, and many others, who provided for them out of their resources.
We can be lulled into the sense that Jesus is just walking around Galilee with these 12 followers, and there they are, and we don't often stop to think, what did they eat, where did they stay, how did they have enough money to get food for the next night?
Bishop Tom Wright.
But Luke does give us an answer, that there were some women who were quite well-to-do, who had followed Jesus from Galilee, and who had their own resources, and would be maybe not doing the same kind of frontline mission that the 12 were doing, but they were there in the background and helping. And Jesus regards them as, in all sorts of ways, every bit as important as the men. And then, of course, what happens in the great transition in the death and resurrection of Jesus is that it's basically the women who are around at the end, and it's the women who go to the tomb, and it's the women who are the first people to tell others that Jesus is alive again. And then they are among the leaders in the early church.
The early Christians used to meet together over supper, and over time this meal developed into what we call the Eucharist, or the Holy Communion. Perhaps this is why Luke, who was writing his Gospel 40 or more years after Jesus' life, makes such a big thing of feasting.
When you're invited by someone to a wedding banquet, do not sit down at the place of honour in case someone more distinguished has been invited.
Give a luncheon or a dinner. Do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbours in case they may invite you in return and you would be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame. And while he was speaking, a Pharisee invited him to dine with him. So he went in and took his place at the table.
I gave a great banquet for him in his house, and there was a large crowd of tax collectors sitting at table with them. And the Pharisees complained to his disciples, saying, "Why do you eat with tax collectors and sinners?"
Paula Gooder is canon theologian at Birmingham Cathedral, and like me, she enjoys her food. She tells me that when Luke writes about feasting, he's anticipating the great messianic banquet, which will occur when God's kingdom finally comes.
There's widespread ideas at the time that when the end times came, when God intervened in the world, everyone would be gathered together into one immense feast where there will be eating and drinking and general joyfulness. And what Jesus is doing in having meals with his disciples is showing that these times are on their way.
It sounds great fun, this messianic banquet. Who's going to be there?
Luke tells us that anyone from the east and the west and the north and the south will come and eat in the kingdom of God. It is a banquet which is going to be available for all, but especially for those who are outcast, for the people who are not welcome in society.
One of the stories I've always loved in Luke's Gospel is the one about Jesus having a meal in the home of a Pharisee, and an intruder comes in who sort of upsets the apple cart. Just paint that scene for me.
Oh, it's a great scene, isn't it? You've got to try and get out of your mind a normal dining room, and instead get into your mind something that was likely to have been a bit like a Roman dining room. We should have been set up with 3 couches round 3 sides of a square. And people would have been there reclining. So the idea is that their heads would be towards the table and their feet would have been outwards towards the wall. The important, the honoured guests would have been on the top couch and the others would have been down the right and the left-hand sides. There would also have been lots of people coming in and out. The women and the slaves and the servants would have been in serving the food. And it's into this scene that this woman who is a sinner comes.
And she comes and she washes Jesus' feet at table. What was the significance of that?
The significance is about honouring a guest. Whenever someone travelled, they would naturally get really dirty and filthy because of the dust on the road. And so this woman would have come and washed Jesus' feet. But there's a twist here, because she doesn't wash it with water. She washes it with her own tears, which is just a beautiful bit of the story, I think.
And the problem is that she's not entirely respectable. She comes from the wrong side of the street, and that upsets some of Jesus' guests.
Well, we don't actually know that she was a prostitute. All we know is that she was a sinner. And as is the way, people assume that women only sin in one direction, and so they give her the reputation of being a prostitute. But anyway, she was somebody who's had sinned in some form or another.
The tradition has tended to identify this woman with Mary Magdalene, and I know Dan Brown in the Da Vinci Code made great play about this. How did that come about?
By a very odd and convoluted route. Mary Magdalene is mentioned in the next passage in Luke's Gospel, immediately following, and she's described there as somebody who's had demons driven out of her, and as someone who's supported Jesus and his disciples, along with some other women. She also appears at the end of the Gospels when she's one of the women who goes to the tomb of Jesus. Somehow or another, she has become associated with the woman who's the sinner, who in their turn has become associated with Mary of Bethany, who anoints Jesus in the three other Gospels. And so we squash together Mary Magdalene, the woman who's a sinner, and Mary of Bethany, all into one big character.
Too many Marys in the Gospels.
Far too many Marys in the Gospels. But we have precious few women as it is. One of my questions is why, when we do have so few women, do we have to make all of them into the same person?
Do you think Luke particularly was open to this idea of Jesus being a friend of women?
I think that Luke is open to outcasts. It is a Gospel in which women are referred to much more than any of the other Gospels, but they're mentioned because they are an outcast. They're like the tax collectors and the sinners and the lepers.
So the significance of this story is that this woman, whether she was from the wrong side of the tracks or not, was forgiven. It's about forgiveness.
It's absolutely about forgiveness. The point that Jesus is making here is that this woman loves him so greatly because she has been forgiven so much. So it's about forgiveness, but it's also about love.
Forgiveness is a very big theme in Luke's Gospel.
Yes, it's there all the way through the Gospel. And you might remember that it's there particularly in the story of the paralytic man who's let down through the roof by his friends so he could get to Jesus. And at that point, Jesus also forgives his sins. And the important thing there, the thing that would make it so shocking, is that only God can forgive sins, and that can only take place in the temple. So for Jesus to forgive sins is actually to make an enormous claim about who he was.
Jesus broke society's taboos in mixing with the outcasts. He put himself further at odds with the Jewish establishment by claiming to forgive sins. In the Radio 4 drama Witness Tomorrow, Jesus makes his way to Jerusalem to confront the power base of the temple. And when I go behind Luke's story, I'll be exploring how Jesus fitted into the complex world of first century Judaism.